We're going to call the committee to order.
Right.
And Representative Johnson will approve the minutes. Oh, wait, we don't have any. We're waiting a little bit. We have some more members to come in. We're going to do brief introductions of staff and members today. We're going to have a overview from House Research, Mr. Pender and company. And as kind of a roadmap for the next few days for the committee, we are not going to be meeting next.
When are we meeting?
We're not meeting next Tuesday because we're going to be in session because of Martin Luther King Day. We will meet next Wednesday. Will be our next committee hearing. We're not meeting tomorrow because of Minnesota One. So that's the next week or so for committee. After that, we don't know what's happening. Welcome to everybody, members and staff. A lot of members have been here before. We have some new members. We have some new staff. Welcome to everybody in the audience. And with that, we'll start with introductions and kind of go around the table. You want to tell who you are and where you're from, and I don't know, what else do we want to know? I guess that's probably enough. We'll start with staff. Dan, if you want to start, Dan Dwight is our CA, and I'll let him, now that I just did it, I'll let him introduce himself.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's right, Dan Dwight. I am the committee administrator for the committee.
I'm Bethany Ehrenholt, and I'm the committee legislative assistant.
And our pages, if you guys want to... Where did we... We'll have our other page. Oh, there you are.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Klein.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Gina Kunish.
Thank you. And we'll have... I think we'll do the two researchers for both sides, Sully and... Go ahead.
I'm Stephen Rubis, GOP Research.
I'm David Sullivan, DFL Research, and a proud graduate of St. John's University.
Bless you. No, we like that. That's a good thing. And with that, I'll start. We'll go members, and we'll go towards the former Chair Atkins after that. I'm Joe Hoppe from Chaska, and this is my fifth term in the legislature.
Good afternoon. Joe Atkins. I represent Inver Grove, South St. Paul, and Sunfish Lake. Former chair, as the current chair introduced me, on behalf of the DFL, modest contingent that managed to stay on the island and weren't voted off in November. We wish the new chair a great couple of years. Don't get too used to it, but...
you know, that's what former Chair David said, too.
Yeah, I know he did. And, as well as to all the new members on the other side of the aisle. I look forward to working with you in the Commerce Committee.
I'm Sheldon Johnson. I represent Southeast St. Paul in my sixth term. I've been on this committee before and found it very useful and helpful, and I look forward to working with Chair Hoppe.
I'm Tom Anzels. I represent the western portion of the Great Mesabi Iron Range. I represent Kuching County and Boise Paper Mill and Lake of the Woods County, where you all come and catch lots of walleyes.
Hi, I'm Linda Slocum. I represent Eastern Richfield, East and Central Bloomington, the Mall of America, the airport, Fort Snelling. Those are mine. So come, spend money. And I was on Commerce last session and enjoyed it greatly. Look forward to working with you.
Denise Dietrich, I represent District 47A, which is all of Coon Rapids and a portion of all of Champlain and a portion of Coon Rapids, and I have not been on the committee before, so I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you.
New members generally bring treats.
Oh, I have some peanut M&Ms in my purse. You want me to share them?
How many do you have? Next, sir.
Mr. Chair, Leon Lilly from North St. Paul Maplewood in my fourth term.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom Tilbury. I happen to be 51B, which is Fridley, Spring Lake Park, a little bit of Blaine, and Moundsview.
Tiny bit of Blaine.
And also, I was on the Commerce Committee my first term, starting my third term, so I had a brief hiatus, so I came back.
Well, welcome back.
I'm Representative Mike Nelson. I represent the southern half of Brooklyn Park, and I'm in my fifth term, and this is my first time on the Commerce Committee.
Well, welcome. Kim?
Tim Sanders, represent Blaine, which is House District 51A. I was on this committee last session. It was by far my favorite committee, so very, very pleased and honored to be back.
And Tim is or Representative Sanders is also the vice chair, and everybody's happy to be on Commerce.
Hoorah. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Pat Mazrell, I am happy to be on Commerce. District 41B, West Bloomington, South Edina.
I'm Kurt Doubt. Mostly Isani County, a little bit of Anoka County, and a portion of Chisago County. And I would agree, I'm also happy to be on Commerce. And I don't have as many opportunities for people to come and spend money, but I would certainly encourage that as well in my district. So.
Mark Murdoch, District 10B, which is half of Otter Tail County, Wadena County, and a little bit of Becker County. And it's my second term. My second tour of duty here, and I couldn't care less if I'm here. Oh, sorry, I'd love to be here.
Okay, we'll write that down.
We've got that on tape. You won't have to worry about being here next year.
Hi, my name is Roger Crawford. I represent Southern Pine County, Hinkley Pine City, all of Kennebec, which is Mora and a part of Isani, freshman.
I'm Kirk Stansrud, serving Eden Prairie and Minnetonka.
Tim O'Driscoll, District 14A.
And, Mr. Pender, I'm assuming, I don't know if all of you guys are going to get up and give us an overview, but Mr. McCormick and everybody, if you want to just introduce yourselves when you come up.
Greg Davids, District 31B, Fillmore and Houston Counties. I border Iowa and Wisconsin.
Diane Anderson, House District 38A, which is the western half of Eagan and a few precincts in Burnsville.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kiefer. I'm from 56B, and that's most of Woodbury and all of Landfall.
Representative Loon, we've all shared our most embarrassing college moment and where we're from and things like that.
College is embarrassing? No. Hi, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for sparing me that. Representative Jennifer Loon from Eden Prairie, District 42B.
Thank you. And before we get to Mr. Pender and do the overview, we don't, in your packets, you won't find any rules. We couldn't find the rules from Chair Atkins, and we're going to continue in that same vein. As a committee, we're not going to have rules on amendments and time and things like that. We should just try, all of us in majority and minority, and I think we did this for the last 4 years, to be as respectful as we can with amendments, and we're not saying there are any time limits, but generally speaking, it helps staff if we can get amendments in on time and get them in early so that everybody knows what's coming and people can get a copy ahead of time. We realize that's not always possible, but to the extent we can, let's try to do that. Other than that, we have on this committee, and maybe there are some other committees like this, but we're really lucky. We have two former chairs here of the committee, Representative Davids and Representative Atkins, and we're going to try to not reinvent the wheel and do the same things that they did, run the committee the same way, and if at the end of the day we can run the committee as half as well as they have done, we'll consider it a success. So with that, thank you all. And with Representative Anderson, if you want to introduce yourself.
I'm Representative Sarah Anderson. I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake.
And with that, we'll go to Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tom Pender. I'm with the House Research Department. That department is a nonpartisan office that serves all House members and all House committees. My handout is in your folder. It's the thing that's headed subject list and shows it's my attempt to come up with the detailed subject list of everything that's within this committee's jurisdiction. And it's, as you can see, it's a long subject list. This committee has a very broad jurisdiction. The House research people who work with this committee are specialized by subject areas, so we can provide expert advice. And the committee deals with so many varied subjects that we need to use four of us to cover all of them. But all four of us have other things to do, and we're not serving this committee full time and overstaffing this committee, and not all of us will be here all the time. If you want to learn more about the subject that's on this list or anything the committee deals with, we're happy to meet with you individually and talk with you about it. If you just let one of us know, we'll set up a time to meet with you and answer your questions. My subject areas mostly deal with things that the Department of Commerce is responsible for. Basically, everything the department does except energy policy are things that I specialize in. And I'm going to speak for about 15 to 20 minutes, and I'll answer questions as we go along, if that's okay with the chair. And I'm going to just touch on a few things on the subject list, because I could, you know, we'd have to be here for several days to cover everything on that list. I'm going to cover insurance first. Insurance in Minnesota is regulated by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm going to focus entirely really on health insurance. In the few minutes I'm going to devote to insurance, but you can see that there are lots of other kinds of insurance listed there on the subject list, and some of them come up every session, and others maybe come up once every 5 or 10 years. Health insurance, the Department of Commerce regulates all health insurance and similar things, except that the Department of Commerce shares HMO regulation with the Department of Health, because there's some aspects of that involve just health and not insurance. So the two departments cooperate on that. And also in the House, this committee shares a jurisdiction with the Health and Human Services Committee in dealing with health insurance. And typically the bills, in recent years, the bills have been referred first to Health and Human Services, and then they come to this committee. I'm going to just mention a couple facts about the Minnesota insurance market. First of all, if you look at the total Minnesota population, about 10% are uninsured. Between 25% and 30% are covered by public programs like medical assistance, Minnesota Care, General Assistance Medical Care, and also the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which is a high-risk pool for people who get turned down for insurance in the private market. The private sector insurance sold to individuals and employers is a total of about 30% of Minnesota's insurance market now. And that leaves about 40% that I haven't mentioned, and that 40% is now covered by what we call self-funded plans or self-insured plans that are offered by employers. And it's not technically insurance, because the employer is not buying insurance coverage from an insurance company or HMO or anything else. It's not shifting risk. It just basically pays for whatever health costs its employees incur. And it can, of course, charge its employee, can require its employees to pay premiums for part of the coverage. And the employers usually contract with what's called a third-party administrator, a TPA, to handle claims and provide a healthcare provider network and all of the other things that insurance companies regularly do, except bear insurance risk. And employers, if they want to, can buy what's called stop loss coverage, where they shift some of the risk to an insurance company. So they might, a large corporation might want to say, well, you know, we'll cover everything under $10 million per year, and after that we'll get insurance coverage for 50% of what's above that, or something like that. So anyway, that 40% of the market is something that we cannot regulate, because the federal ERISA law, which was passed in 1976, preempts state regulation of those self-funded plans. So that's something that we all have to keep in mind, that we really are not regulating the whole market in this committee or in this legislature. I'm going to move on now and kind of go to the if you look at the subject area of health insurance on my handout there, I'm going to jump down now from health down to the bottom, interaction with federal law. And here I'm also going to be talking about health insurance, namely the federal health care reform bill that was passed in March of 2010. And this is something that the states are going to have to deal with one way or another, unless it gets repealed or really substantially changed, or unless a court declares it to be unconstitutional. And that law sets out a process where the states and federal government would share responsibilities for developing and administering the health insurance reforms that are in that law. Some pieces of it are already in effect. For instance, the one that gets the most attention is the coverage of adult children up to age 26, regardless of whether that, quote, child is a student or not, or dependent, financially dependent on the parents or not, or living in the home or not, or even married or not. But there are a number of other things, too, that have already gone into effect on September 23rd, and some others that have gone into effect nationwide January 1st, including minimum medical loss ratios requiring that the amount paid out for health care and similar things must be either 80% of the premiums or 85%, depending on the product. And there are a number of other things like that, too, that are already going into effect. So the federal bill is phasing in and is expected to be mostly fully phased in by January 1st, 2014. And states are generally working on getting prepared for that, including setting up and operating a health insurance exchange, which is basically an electronic marketplace where people who want to buy insurance and people who want to sell it connect with each other, and payment streams can come from various sources, including employer contributions, employee contributions, public sector subsidies from the federal and state level. So it's a sort of way of combining payment streams where necessary to get everybody covered and comply with the federal individual mandate, which is the most controversial part of the bill. And the general advice to states is to do what's necessary to get ready to operate in this new environment, and not take a chance on having the law be repealed, for instance, because it may not be repealed, and then the states wouldn't be ready. And so one of the main things that is recommended for states is that in 2011 they pass a bill at least setting up a structure for the health insurance exchange, deciding who's going to be in charge of it, whether it be a state agency or maybe a new nonprofit corporation that the state would create and have laws telling it what to do, and generally start working on this. The federal law requires the government to check up on the states in January of 2013, and if a state looks like it's not going to be ready to operate an exchange, the federal law requires the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services to get ready to operate a federal exchange in that state if it turns out to not meet the 2014 deadline, and that federal exchange would be whatever the federal government wants to do with an exchange, and the states would have nothing to say about what it would be like. Whereas if states get prepared for this, they can make some decisions on what it'll do.
Mr. Pender, we have our first question of the year. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pender, there's 220 some unions and corporations that have received waivers from the Department of Human Services. What are they receiving waivers from? Is the loss ratio that the Senator was making last week, or what are they getting waivers from? They don't have to comply with the law.
they're getting waivers from the minimum coverage requirements. So in other words, if you have a restaurant, let's say, which is now providing what are called mini med policies, minimum kind of coverage things that might cover $10,000 worth of health expenses in a year, that kind of plan can't meet the new federal requirements for what's required. For instance, the federal requirement on how much, what the annual limits can be are phasing in, and there's, you know, it's at something like 250,000 already, and so these little plans aren't going to make it, and so these exemptions are basically temporary for now exemptions to let these kind of employer plans continue for a while, because the employers simply say, well, it's, you know, it's that or nothing. We can't afford to provide more extensive coverage.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Penner, looks like when they have to meet those requirements, it'd be nothing for their employees.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, that could be, but if the individual mandate is in effect, then the employees are going to have to get coverage one way or another. If not from their employer, then they'll have to pay for it themselves, and maybe with help from state and federal subsidies if they can't afford it, or pay the fine for not having coverage. That would be cheaper, at least initially. That's right.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Pender.
I'm going to move on now to a little further down on my subject list there, financial institutions. And financial institutions are also regulated under Minnesota law by the Department of Commerce. And here again, there's a federal interaction in that banks and credit unions can choose their regulator. They can choose either to be state chartered and be regulated by the Department of Commerce, or they can choose to be federally regulated and be regulated by one of the federal banking agencies. And so we have in Minnesota, most of the large banks and credit unions are federally regulated, and the smaller ones are more likely to be state regulated. There are more state regulated ones, however, than federal regulated ones, but the really large ones tend to be federal. The federal ones are not subject to state laws, except for general laws that apply regardless of whether they're a bank or a credit union. So, I mean, they have to pay property taxes, and if they foreclose mortgages, they have to foreclose them using Minnesota law, because they have to respect our real estate laws and so on. So sometimes it's hard to see where the line is. But generally, if it involves a bank or credit union's central functions and they're federally chartered, they're federally regulated, and we have very little authority over them. Also, if you look at the list there under financial institutions, you see a lot of things that aren't banks. You see industrial loan and thrift companies, finance companies, mortgage banking companies, mortgage brokers, payday lenders, check cashing businesses, pawn brokers, and so on. And that's an increasing share of what we call financial institutions. And those kind of businesses are doing more and more business. And each year, I think since I've been here, there have been laws introduced to either start regulating one or the other of them, or beef up the regulations on one or the other of them. And they it's a kind of a continuing process. Also in financial institutions, there are interactions with federal laws in addition to just the fact that some banks are federally regulated, and we are likely to have that as a continuing feature of financial institution regulation in Minnesota. I'm going to skip now to the back page of that handout. And the fourth item down there is occupational licensing by the Department of Commerce. And this is something this committee has jurisdiction over because it has jurisdiction over everything the Department of Commerce does except for the energy part of the department. And I list some of the occupations there that the Department of Commerce regulates, including some that you'd expect them to regulate and others that seem a little unusual, like regulating athlete agents. But we do regulate them. And the department typically licenses in these industries, licenses either the firm or the individuals working in the firm or both. So, for instance, in the realty world, you could license the realty firm, the brokerage, the real estate broker, in other words, or you can license the individual real estate salespeople, or you can regulate both. And in the case of real estate, we do regulate both, and we require continuing education for those people too. Other situations, we don't regulate both. So, for instance, debt collectors are listed there in the middle of that paragraph, and that's a category where we regulate the firm, we regulate and license the debt collecting firm, but we don't regulate or license the individual debt collectors. Instead, our laws put the burden on the firm that we're licensing and regulating to regulate its own people, to do criminal background checks and other things to make sure that these people are qualified to do the work that they're doing. I'm going to skip from here down to the consumer protection paragraph. I list a few consumer protection laws that we already have, and there are a lot of others that I don't list there. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on them, except just to mention that one of the issues with a consumer protection law, unless it's a law that governs something we're already licensing and regulating, is who's going to enforce that law. And sometimes, and basically if we're going to enforce a law to protect the consumer against something, let's say it's selling a gift card that violates our law in some way. If we don't have a state agency regulating that seller, then we typically have to either put something in the law making it a crime and having it enforced by the criminal justice system. And sometimes it's hard to think about law enforcement people spending their time on those things instead of the more serious crimes that they feel are a priority, or we have to count on the consumer suing the business if the consumer feels cheated and it's not a crime and no there's no state regulator of the business, so sometimes we put something in a law saying that the consumer can sue for a violation of the law. Or occasionally the Attorney General's office can sue on behalf of consumers in general. But I just mention that because I get asked to draft a lot of consumer protection kind of bills, and that's always my first question is, who do you want to enforce this law? The final thing I'm going to talk about is the next category down on the subject list, the Miscellaneous Department of Commerce Responsibilities. And I'll just mention there that the department does have general enforcement authority that cover everything that it regulates. And it does a lot of things that we don't think of the department as doing. For instance, it has a weights and measures division that goes around and inspects gas pumps at places where gasoline is sold. And you've maybe seen this on a pump as you've been pumping your gas, and it has a little sticker on it saying inspected by the Department of Commerce Weights and Measures Division and shown to be accurate as of such and such a date. Or they even inspect the scales in a supermarket. If you go to the deli counter and they have a scale there that weighs cold cuts or something, every once in a while the department comes around and checks the scale just to be sure that it's measuring accurately. But one thing that I think can be especially helpful to legislators is that the department can respond to consumer complaints. and the department maintains a employees who are who work on their consumer response team, and they answer phones and they arrange for investigations if necessary. They have a toll-free number for consumers to call and also a Twin Cities number for that purpose. And they try to answer the consumer's question, or if a law has been broken, they try to get the company to make things right. And this can sometimes be helpful in dealing with constituent complaints that you might get. So I'm going to stop there, and if there are any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them, and otherwise my colleagues here will take the next parts.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Any questions? If not, who's up next? Mr. Eleff. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Eleff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Bob Eleff. I work at the House Research Department, and I'll be staffing this committee with respect to telecommunications issues this session. And I'd like to give you a brief flavor of the kinds of issues that are within the jurisdiction of the committee. For better or ill, federal law preempts the state regulation of many telecommunications issues, and it's severely restricted the scope of state action. I'd also say that advancing technology, increased competition, and deregulation efforts over the last 15 years have also served to shrink the area in which the state can act. For example, with respect to cable television, states do not have the authority to regulate monthly subscriber fees or the suite of channels offered by any company or programming content or the hardware subscribers must have to get service. States do have the authority to decide who issues franchises to provide cable services at the local level and what the requirements to obtain a franchise are. And the details of those franchises are negotiated between the municipalities and the providers. The internet or broadband services is another issue that it's regulated to the extent that it is at the federal level. Some state actions taken in this area in recent years include convening a statewide advisory panel to develop statewide broadband goals and a strategy to reach them. And last session we incorporated those goals into statute. The state also contracted with an independent group called Connected Nation to do a very detailed survey of state broadband penetration down to the census block level. So now we have a very good idea of what areas in the state lack broadband services. The regulation of telephone services is shared by both federal and state authorities. But state authority is largely restricted to landline phones, a market segment which, as you all know, is shrinking. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission has no direct authority over the prices and very little over the operations of wireless carriers or providers of voice over internet protocol services, which are the fastest growing segments of the industry. And even with respect to landline phones, the Commission's jurisdiction has been receding, largely as a result of deregulation efforts that have been occurring since the 1990s. The PUC does not directly regulate telephone rates anymore. It no longer sets profit levels or the rates charged by telephone companies. Beginning in 1995, different kinds of plans called alternative form of regulation plans were implemented, and they've essentially eliminated what's been this traditional rate of return regulation. The only telephone rates that the Commission regulates directly are single-party landline, residential, and business lines, again, both of which are shrinking segments of the market. A much larger proportion of its time these days is spent implementing the requirement that landline telephone companies interconnect with competitive carriers offering newer technologies and the controversies that ensue over the details of those interconnections. Nevertheless, there are some areas of telecommunications operation that the legislature does have the authority to regulate. One of these is consumer protection and fraud. The legislature has passed laws outlawing a procedure known as cramming, which is third-party billing for services that the customer does not authorize. We also have laws against a procedure known as slamming, which is changing a customer's carrier without that customer's consent. There are also laws against sending false and misleading emails or junk faxes, and also laws that relieve the customers of liability for the unauthorized use of a cell phone. We also have statutes that govern the operation of phone solicitors. Another telecommunications issue in which the state is involved is in providing active assistance to low-income populations and also to those with communications impairments such as deafness and blindness. There is a plan called the Minnesota Telephone Access Plan, which provides a discount of $1.75 per month on local landline telephone services for income-eligible recipients. There's a program called Telephone Access or Telecommunications Access Minnesota, which helps deaf, hard of hearing, and those with communicating disabilities to have access to telephone services. The state also, I guess the committee's committee also might have some issues arise with the 911 system in the state, although those issues are also shared with the Public Safety Committee. There is one issue that I think is likely to come up this session. We had an informational hearing on it at the very end of last session, and that's something called interstate access charges, and that arises as follows. You remember I mentioned interconnection a few moments ago between long distance and local telephone companies. Long distance companies don't own all the lines that are required to provide long distance service. Typically, your call will start out at your local telephone company. It'll get switched to a long distance line and then terminate over another local line. So the question arises, how much should the long distance carrier pay those local carriers to originate and terminate calls for the use of their lines, essentially? And there are both intrastate access charges and interstate access charges when calls are made outside of state. But I think what I'm concerned with mostly now is the intrastate access charges, if you would call from Minneapolis to Bemidji, for example. So in the 1980s, the Federal Communications Committee created a system of access charges to compensate local phone companies for the use of their lines. And during the 1990s, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission held a series of proceedings that lowered those intrastate access rates, but they continued to remain far above interstate access rates. And that is something that long-distance companies are obviously concerned about, and it's an issue that results or that concerns literally hundreds of millions of dollars a year in terms of who should get that money, long-distance versus local companies. And about 19 or 20 other states in the last couple of years have dealt with that issue, and I think it's likely to come up here in Minnesota as well. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Eliff. Any questions? Representative Dietrich. Oh, Mr. Eliff, we've got one quick question.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this isn't a question but a request. The map that you indicated that we have access to now about where broadband is throughout the state, is that in the report by that the broadband task force, or is that a subsequent piece of information?
Better than that, it's available online because it's being updated. And I'll make sure to send the committee the address so that members can access it.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Newman, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Anita Newman, also of House Research. I do the labor, employment, economic development, and some of the miscellaneous issues that come before this committee. And my apologies to two or three members who have already sat through a version of this presentation in a committee right before this. You're going to basically hear the same thing, sorry. The Department of Labor and Industry is under the purview of this committee, and that includes all the wage and hour issues, minimum wage, prevailing wage, overtime, drug and alcohol testing, child labor, family and medical leave, the whole gamut of those issues, all the construction codes and licensing, that's the building code, all the construction-related licensing, fees, inspections, elevators, boilers, those types of items, OSHA issues, all the workplace safety and health issues, workers' compensation, and the apprenticeship programs. My labor and employment issues before this committee, also it's PELRA and all the collective bargaining, public and private collective bargaining related issues, although the state contracts are handled in the state government committee. Then there's the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which is a very broad-based department. It's all the community and business development issues. They have a labor market information and forecasting unit, which this committee will use a lot of that information, which is very good, very helpful information on workforce needs, unemployment projections, business. They do a lot of business forecasting and projection. The employment and training programs, VOC rehab programs, things like state services for the blind, and a big one is, especially the last 2 or 3 years, is the unemployment insurance. And the unemployment changes generally run through this committee as well. And one of the upcoming issues specifically in unemployment insurance is the federal government did another extension of unemployment benefits. The state will have to take action for our on-trigger in order to access the 100% payment of those federal benefits. And that is likely something that this panel will take a look at. I assist Mr. Pender in some of the consumer protection issues, in addition to working on some of the miscellaneous things. For example, the Made in U.S. flags and uniforms bill came through this committee, as did an example of a couple years ago. The committee discussed restroom access in private businesses for persons with certain chronic diseases. So as you can see, it's a fairly broad-based group of issues that you'll be looking at and that I'm here to help you with. That is my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Newman. Any questions? And as I recall, the Made in the USA debate and the restroom thing, those were two of our finest committee moments, I think. Representative Mullery.
I think.
And by the way, you need to introduce yourself. You came in late, and we all introduced ourselves and said where we're from and what our dreams, goals, and aspirations are.
You can Representative Davids is finished already?
he submitted his in written form.
And it's on that cart there. I'm Joe Mullery from the north half of North Minneapolis. I've been on this committee, I think, since 2001. Very interested in consumer protection, especially.
And did you have a question as well?
Yes, I was. It was more to the point of fine points in the committee. I thought that Representative Gunther's urination collection bill was the most important I've heard in my years. Or maybe not the most important, but the most entertaining.
If we get a bill like that this year, we will refer that to the Jobs and Labor Committee, which Representative Gunther chairs.
I'm supposed to say you're happy to be here.
Mr. McCormick, whenever you're ready.
Aren't you happy to be here?
Yes.
As long as you keep them out of the chair position when you're gone.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Pat McCormick. I'm director of the House Research Department, and I also handle liquor regulation and gambling regulation for this committee. And I'm sad to say that Representative Atkins usually forgot that I existed and I didn't have to do an overview when he was chair. So Representative Hoppe remembered me, and here I am.
Here is two favorite issues.
There you go. Commerce Committee, yeah. will handle regulation of liquor in the state of Minnesota. Liquor is regulated by what's known as the three-tier system of regulation. The three tiers are the manufacturing level, the wholesale level, and the retail level. This is something that came out of the Prohibition. When Prohibition was repealed, these three levels were established in law. Minnesota's law is also sometimes known as the Coleman Act because it was Senate Majority Leader Coleman in the 1970s put the current structure in place and the current chapter of law in place. It's fair to say that since Senate Majority Leader Coleman wrote the Coleman Act, we've been slowly fraying the edges of the three-tier system ever since. One of the aspects of this system is also that we allow local licensing and regulatory control. A local government is free to deviate from Minnesota's laws and be more restrictive of alcohol if they so choose. Over the years, a number of different kinds of organization at the retail level have cropped up. And so we have on-sale bars, essentially, and we have off-sale liquor stores that are exclusive. We also have a variety of other entities, such as a municipal liquor store, consumption and display permit operations. We have brew pubs. We have microbreweries that arguably could be different than brew pubs if we decide to legalize them. We have wineries. We have farm wineries. Bed and breakfasts have special permits to allow service of alcohol. Each of these areas is something that the Commerce Committee here will take a look at. We also regulate alcohol as a controlled substance, which means that we have concerns over whether entities have the proper dram shop liability insurance and what the levels of dram shop liability should be. We handle age limits for alcohol consumption, access to alcohol, consumer protection through quality control of alcohol, brand registration, things like that are registering and controlling how manufacturers create alcohol and bring it to the state of Minnesota. The Department of Public Safety is the regulatory agency. Their liquor control division will come before this committee. Typically, we have one major liquor bill every year called the Omnibus Liquor Bill. We also handle, in this committee, gambling. And gambling is something that is handled through the concept of what is legal in the state of Minnesota and what is not legal in the state of Minnesota. It's important to back up and recognize that when Minnesota created a constitution, states were concerned about the control of gambling, and they often banned lotteries. And lotteries had a different meaning in the 19th century. A lottery was essentially any form of gambling. The definition of gambling then came out of this ban on lotteries, and it's very simple. Gambling is a consideration. I pay a dollar for a chance. I have random luck in play, and then to win a prize. So you a consideration for a chance to win a prize, and that is gambling. And that classically was a lottery, which was forbidden in the Constitution in the state of Minnesota. Therefore, to allow gambling to go forward, we've had to have constitutional amendments. There are three major forms of gambling in the state of Minnesota. What we call charitable gambling, and charitable gambling consists of bingo, pull tabs, paddle wheels, tip boards, and raffles. Charitable gambling is regulated by the Lawful Gambling Control Board. And we have a former director of the Lawful Gambling Control Board, Representative Ann Zeltz, on our committee. Second form would be, originally it was pari-mutuel racing, which was controlled by the Racing Commission. Over the years, we've also added card clubs, which are regulated and controlled by the Racing Commission and are allowed at the two racing sites. And then the final form is our Minnesota State Lottery. And it's another important note, which I always make sure members of this committee know, is that we regulate these forms of gambling. We also have a role in deciding what forms are legal and illegal. Sadly, the Commerce Committee does not spend the revenues that are generated by gambling.
Not yet.
Not yet. That's traditionally something that happens in the Ways and Means Committee. The final area of gambling in Minnesota worth comment is Indian gambling. Indian gambling was legalized under the Indian Gambling Regulatory Act, which was passed by Congress. The state of Minnesota only has very limited say over Indian gambling. We do negotiate compacts, which are allowed under state law, with the tribes. And we also have a limited relationship with the tribes where they pay for some regulation that we do of tribal gambling. So those are the overviews for liquor and gambling. I can answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from anybody? Seeing none. With that, I think, unless anybody has any general questions, there's one thing I forgot to announce. When we meet next Wednesday, the 19th, we will be having, and this is for people at the table and those in the audience, we will be having, I don't know, what do we call this, lobbyist overview day? Anybody that wants to can come in, and you'll get 3 minutes to tell us anything or everything, who you are, where you're from, what your favorite color is, what issues you represent. You know, any and all lobbyists or interested parties that want to come and have a couple of minutes before the committee to introduce yourselves, we're happy to have you here. Anything else? Anything we're forgetting? With that, I think we're adjourned.